15. The alarm clock woke her. The bedroom, with its indistinct shapes, was gray with early morning light. She struggled up and found the alarm clock and shut it off. Her body ached, and all her muscles, all her joints, were sore. Her ribs, she remained motionless, wincing, felt as if they were cracked and broken. Reaching down, she massaged her waist. Her skin was tender to the touch. The night, the whole night long, they had gone on and on. And then, as she pushed the covers away, she put her hand to her face and felt the hardened, swollen ring around her eye. Beside her, still asleep, Art Emanuel lay with his head buried in the covers. His blonde hair, in the first sunlight, looked clean, bleached white, completely pure. She did not know how she could get up. For a long time, she simply sat. She left her eye alone and tried not to think about it. At 8 o'clock, she at last slid from the bed, put a robe around her, and went stiffly along the hall to the bathroom. Even the soles of her feet hurt. Her flesh was dry, brittle, unyielding. She was, she thought to herself, a kind of dried corn husk. In the bathroom mirror, she inspected her eye. The flesh around it was bluish-black, swollen so that the eye was almost shut. When she lifted cold water to it, the eye closed. For a time, she could not get it open. The eye burned furiously, and she thought, "So that's how it feels. That's what it's like." Going to the station was out of the question. She wondered how long the discoloration and swelling would remain. 2 days? Three? And, in addition, the urgent, ceaseless sex had worn her out. Once, in her high school days, she and two other girls had hiked to the top of Mount Tamalpais. At the end of that hike, she had been tired, but she was more tired now. This was complete. This was absolute exhaustion. She fixed coffee. While the coffee heated, she lit a cigarette. By the time the coffee was ready, she felt better. She ate a little cottage cheese and dry toast, drank the coffee, and then washed the dishes. Her head ached, and she swallowed 2 aspirin tablets, standing at the sink in her robe, her feet bare. After that, she walked back into the bedroom. In the bed, Art Emanuel slept on. One arm was thrown out, the hand open, fingers trailing from the bed. His clothes, with her clothes, were piled upon the chair by the bed. He did not look tired at all, and she thought to herself, this is what she had talked about, this vitality. Now, she thought, she had it. Here, sleeping away in the bed, here it was. From the chair, she took some of her clothes and started to dress, but she did not have the strength. The time was 8:30. She went into the living room and telephoned the station. "Hello," she said. "This is Patricia." Ted Haynes said, "What is it, Patricia?" "I wonder if it would be all right if I didn't come in today." Her voice was a rasp. She did not have to force it. "I've got the flu or something. What do you think? I haven't missed any time so far this year." Ted Haynes outlined a long list of medicines to buy, told her to stay in bed until she was well, wished her good luck, and then hung up. Stay in bed, she thought. It was funny. It was really funny. Returning to the bedroom, she tossed her robe over the chair with the rest of the clothes, and then, lifting the covers back, got into bed beside the sleeping boy. In the half-light of the bedroom, she leaned above him, her elbows resting on the pillow, her face close to his. Her mouth brushed across him, and she brought her hands to the sides of his face. She lifted his head with her hands, gazing down at him. Presently, she pushed aside the covers and lowered herself onto him. She rested her body against his chest, his face, his legs and hips and feet. How warm he was! She felt his heart beating. It moved at her breasts, his heart deep inside him, stirring and awake. She heard him breathing. She put her ear to his chest and crouched there, listening, holding on to him. In that position, she dozed. Some time later, when the room was full of light, she was awakened by the pressure of his arms. His eyes were open, and he was grinning up at her. He had taken hold of her and was holding her in his grip, clutching her where she was sore, where she hurt the most. "Oh, no," she said. "We can't. We've had enough." "Sure," he said. She slid away from him, but he held on to her. "You ought to be exhausted," she said, marveling. You ought to be dead. Did you get up? He said. A little while ago, you were gone. I ate breakfast. Your eye looks awful. She said, I can't go to work. I can't go outside like this. Sitting up, unfastening his fingers from her, she put her hand to her face, exploring the flesh by her nose, by her brow.
Is it going down?
Some.
What can I do?
Just wait, he said. You never had a black eye?
No.
She lay back, her knees drawn up to keep him away.
Leave me alone, she said.
The covers scratched her cheek. He was lifting them around her, covering her. That made her feel better.
Thanks, she said.
You still look okay, he said, even with it.
She said, you remember when we were up on Twin Peaks? You said you loved me.
Yeah, he said.
Do you?
Yeah, he said. Sure I do.
Then how could you hit me?
She shifted to face him.
How can you do that to somebody you love? Don't ever do it again, Art. Promise me?
You were leaving.
I was going out. I wasn't leaving.
He said, what was I supposed to do? Just stand there?
And that knife, where did you get it? From that creepy pal of yours? You shouldn't be mixed up in things like that, Art. Don't you know that?
That was the first time, he murmured.
Throw the damn thing away somewhere.
Okay, he said.
Will you do that? If you're going to go around with me, you can't do things like that. You know that, Art.
He said nothing. Beside him, she waited. She listened. When he did not answer, she reached out her hand and placed it on his body. This was not so bad, surely. This was nothing to complain about. She lay in bed, and time passed. Hours went by. The sun climbed in the sky, and the room became warmer, brighter. The air became stuffy. Art said, hey, I'm hungry. How long are we going to stay here? Let's get up.
You won't always be able to do this, Art, she said.
Restlessly, he shifted about in the bed. It must be almost noon.
Yes, she said. It's 11:30.
She rolled over until she lay against him. She put her arm under him, bearing his weight on her wrist, her elbow. Then she drew herself up onto him, but only her head and shoulders. With her hand, she held him away from her.
No, she said. I just want to look at you.
That seemed to trouble him. He did not enjoy being looked at. Gradually, he became embarrassed.
What's wrong? She said.
I don't know. It's so light in here.
The light?
She raised herself up.
Oh, she said. You think it's wrong for me to see you. Is that it?
I just don't understand why you like to lie around doing nothing. But still she sat, resting back on her heels, her bare knees jutting out before her, her palms resting on her thighs. And his dismay increased.
There's nothing wrong with this, she said. Are you ashamed of me? Are you ashamed of yourself?
She tossed the covers away from him. The covers settled to the floor, leaving both of them uncovered.
You have a nice body. You should be proud of it.
He got up, picked up his clothes, and dressed. And she watched that, too. Let's eat, he said. Remaining on the bed, she said,
I just want to lie here.
Come on. His face was sullen.
She said, lie here with me.
Stretched out on the bed, she lifted up her hand, reaching toward him.
I thought you were insatiable.
His discomfort struck her as ironic.
Now that I'm rested up, you don't want to. Or do you just want to do it at night?
You're only supposed to do it at night, he said.
Why?
Because it's dark, he said. She laughed. The bizarre modesty, the stilted ideas, old teachings, concealment, and the word that came to her mind was prudery. During the night, he had battled with her until she was sore and worn out, but now in the sunlight, he refused even to stay in the room.
How was it?
She asked. Okay, he said angrily. And she thought he could not bring himself to speak of it. Wrong to speak, she thought. And she thought, my God, wrong to talk about it in front of a woman. He can talk about it with his drugstore pals,
They probably talk about it all the time. But I'm like his mother or a teacher. I shouldn't hear about it. And she thought in a stupid sense. She was in love with him. She had a crush on him, an adolescent crush. The kid in her was aroused. But she could not help being contemptuous. What did he have to say? He was ignorant, young. He shuffled his feet and stood inert. But he was nice-looking. He was strong and, she thought, he had a natural purity, from his youth. The fact that he was so young, he had done so little, he knew so little. "How did you imagine it would be," she said, "when you were a child? Is it anything like you expected, or did you have a lot of idealistic dreams and notions?" He grunted. "Do you know anything about erogenous zones?" she said. On his face was an expression of distrust and horror. He did not know what she meant, but he did not like the sound of it. "I think there are 9 of them," she said, "in a woman. Probably it differs between different women." At the door he lingered. He was unable to leave, but he wanted to leave. She said, "Would you feel better if I put something on?"
"You ought to get up," he said.
"Did you know that some women can come to a climax by fondling their breasts?" He left the room. In the kitchen, he collected eggs and bacon from the refrigerator. For a while, she remained on the bed, and then she got up and put on a skirt and blouse. And then she changed her mind. She put on only a half slip from her waist to her knees. Wearing that, she followed him into the kitchen and sat down at the table. Smoking a cigarette, she watched him fix himself breakfast. "What is it?" she said. "Do I bother you?"
"Go put something more on," he said.
"I don't get a chance to do this," she said. "How many times in my life can I loll around like this? I don't have to work today. I can't go to work with my eye the way it is."
"Suppose somebody comes?"
She shrugged. "Suppose they do. You can answer the door."
"Suppose Jim Briskin shows up?"
"Oh," she said, eyeing him. "Does that worry you?"
I don't like it."
"What do you want me to put on? Do you want me to dress up? Are we going somewhere?"
He seated himself across from her and began to eat. The smell of bacon made her ill, but she remained at the table. Smoke from her cigarette drifted around him. Turning his chair, he ate with his plate between his knees.
"That's no way to eat," she said.
"Go to hell,"
he mumbled, his mouth full, his face flushed.
"Didn't your mother teach you how to act at the table? Does Rachel let you eat that way? There's so many things you're going to have to learn. What about your clothes? You can't wear those again today. Don't you have anything else you can wear?"
"They're home."
"Then buy some more. Or go get them."
Lazily, she leaned back, her arm over the top of the chair.
"Why don't you take the car and go by your place and pick up your clothes? And you need a shave."
Reaching, she touched his chin. He ducked away.
"It's true. You can't go out like that."
Throwing down his fork, he left the table. She went into the bedroom and finished dressing. When she came back out, he was standing at the living room window, his hands in the back pockets of his slacks. The crease was gone from the slacks, and they hung unevenly, bagging at the knees. All night, his clothes had been piled up on the chair.
"How do you like this skirt?" she said.
She had put on a bright blue skirt and a white frilly blouse. He said nothing. He did not look.
"I thought I'd go downtown and shop," she said. "If I'm not going to have to go to work, there are some clothes I want to buy. I have a list of errands."
"How about your eye?"
"It's improving."
She went to the basin in the bathroom and splashed cold water on it. The skin was discolored, but it was not as hard, not as distended.
"You can't go outside looking like that," he said at the bathroom door. "You look awful."
"Okay," she said. "We'll stay here, then."
"I'm not sticking around here," he said vehemently. "I can't stand just sitting around. Anyhow, I have to get over to Larson's. I'm supposed to be there every day."
"All right," she said. "You do that. I'll stay here and catch up on my letter writing."
As an afterthought, she added,
"There's another thing you probably should do."
"What?"
"Shouldn't you call Rachel and tell her you're okay? She's probably worried about you."
Art said, "Let's go away."
"Go away? With you?"
He gave her a deadly, impassioned look. Sobered, she said,
"What do you mean? For how long?"
"Let's just go."
"My job," she said.
"The hell with your job. Pack your stuff up and let's go."
"Do you have any money?"
"No," he said.
"Then," she said, "how can we go away?"
Now she felt more secure.
"And I don't have any money. If you want, you can look around. Look in my purse if you care to."
"You can sell your car."
"No, I can't."
The presumption shocked her, the absolute disregard of her interests.
"I don't have the pink slip. I still owe $1,800 on it. I won't own it until May 1958.
"You can borrow on it."
He seemed to have made up his mind. Dealing her possessions out, she thought.
"Why do you want to go away?"
she asked, unable to follow the process involved. Impulsive, she thought. It was a boy's whim. But the coolness was shocking. The assumptions. Art said,
"Somebody might come here."
"Like who?"
"Jim Briskin."
"Why does Jim Briskin worry you?"
"Because," he said in his brusque, unreasoning voice, "you're his girl." He made her pack all her things, her clothes from the closet, medicine from the bathroom, the cosmetics from her vanity table in the bedroom, the slips and bras and underpants and stockings and sweaters and blouses from the dresser drawers. As fast as he could, he carried everything to the bed, on which her suitcases rested end to end, one of them already full, the next half full. Whenever she looked up, there he was with more things. No limit, she thought. How systematic he was. And, she thought, in the face of this flow, she drifted along. She was captured and held fast. "What else?" he demanded.
"There's enough here already," she said. "I don't really need all this."
He said, "I don't know what you need. Let's not take it. Take what you need."
"If you won't tell me where we're going or how long we'll be gone, I can't tell what I need. Isn't that so?"
But his mind was on the car. People sell cars they don't own. You can get something out of it. Picking up the telephone, he called a number. As she packed, she listened to him. He was asking questions in monosyllables and grunts. She thought, "If I'm not careful and do not keep some control, I will give him the car. I will let him take everything."
"Who was that?"
she said when he hung up.
"Who did you call?"
"My brother."
"I didn't know you had a brother. Is he older than you?"
"Yes," he said.
The idea was ominous. A bigger, more formidable Art. The same, she thought. The same, but larger.
"He says you can sell your equity," Art said.
"How does he know?"
"He has a used car lot."
"It doesn't make any difference," she said. "I'm not going to part with my car."
"How big's your equity?"
She said, "You can forget it, Art. I have to have that car."
From the heap which he had assembled on the bed, she separated towels. They would not need towels.
"Once you get on something," she said, "you just go on and on. If you'll shut up about the car."
She pretended not to see him. She carried the towels back to the dresser.
"I have some money in a savings account."
"How much?"
"The passbook's in the drawer."
She indicated the table.
"I forget. Whatever it is, you can have it."
He opened the passbook.
$200, he said, pleased. "That'll do."
"What are you going to do about clothes?" she asked. "Your own clothes."
Reluctantly, he said, "What kind of clothes do I need?"
"Don't you know? Good God, don't you buy your own clothes? Does she buy them for you?"
His eyes on the floor, he said,
"Socks, I guess."
"Socks and shirts, and a suit of some kind, and underwear."
Her voice was rising, and she remembered the trouble it had caused, the fights with Jim. She heard herself gain the acrimonious tone, the animation. And underneath it was something different, something that she did not recognize.
"You're as helpless as a baby. Go out and go to some men's clothing store and tell them your stuff was destroyed, or it was all lost. Get a neutral suit, blue or brown or gray, single-breasted. Don't get any sport coats."
"Why not?"
"Because," she said, Sport coats make you look like a kid dressed up for Saturday night.
He was attending, aware of her conviction.
Get a couple of sport shirts, she said, and some plain white shirts.
And then the yearning beneath the anger came out, and she said,
I'll go with you.
No, he said. But she had made up her mind. Going through her purse, she kept alive a running patter of talk. Her eagerness was working through her, and she could not shut it off.
Why should I stake you to an outfit? What kind of a thing is this? Am I supposed to buy your clothes and feed you and support you? Am I keeping you? Is that it? What am I supposed to be getting out of it?
He had no answer. He hung his head.
I'll tell you one thing, she said. You're supposed to look out for a woman, not live off her. I even have to think for you. I have to tell you how to dress yourself and cross the street. How long do you think I'm going to put up with this? I think I've had just about enough. This really is something. You better take a good look at yourself.
Calm down, he said. But she could not calm down.
Do you know what's going to happen? She said. I'm the one who's going to have to suffer for all this. I'll lose my lease here. I'll probably lose my job. And Rachel's probably after me, and Jim Briskin, too. And I'll wind up borrowing on my car. I can't afford to do that, Art. I just can't. And that's the last of Bob Posen. You don't have to worry. If the police show up, it'll be me they'll arrest. Contributing to the delinquency of a minor. God, you're just a child. You're like a baby, a little boy. My little boy.
She swept past him, hurrying away from him so that she was not close enough to touch him. She did not trust herself so close to him. Going into the bedroom, she closed the door, stood for a moment, and then she thought, what's gone wrong with me? What is it? Taking off her skirt and blouse, she changed to a blue suit. She made herself up with more powder than usual. She obscured the discoloration around her eye. Then she put on stockings and heels and a white hat with a veil. That does it, she thought, except for the purse and gloves. She put her things into a dark leather purse, tugged on her gloves, and opened the door. Her muscles were so unresponsive that she thought some blight had fallen onto her. She was dominated by invisible fluids. As if the blight had made a passage into her nerve centers and had lodged there.
I don't think my eye will be too noticeable like this, she said.
Art said, you look like you're going to a wedding.
Do I?
Approaching him, she said,
what about my eye? How does it look?
Not too bad. You can still see it. But she saw his admiration. She knew how good this suit was for her. She saw the response.
Jim likes this suit, she said.
You look okay, he said, and that was as much as he would say. Disappearing into the bathroom, he spent a long time with his hair. She waited, knowing that he was fixing himself up as best he could. Her suit made her feel superior. She was raised up, maintained. She went about the apartment, smoking, pausing to watch his progress. In this high state, she was lazy and at ease. Art, in the bathroom, labored at the mirror. She walked in to inspect his progress. The mirror gave back their combined reflection. How much larger he was than she. But, she thought, she looked good with him. She looked trim and tidy. This was a deep pleasure for her, and she made the most of it. She felt wealthy, expansive. Supervising him, she felt aristocratic.
You have to shave, she said.
With what? Returning to the bedroom, she rested one of the suitcases on the chair arm. Opening it, she took out a plastic-wrapped package from a side pocket.
You can use mine.
He was astonished to see a regular razor and blades. Beside the plastic package was a blue box. On its side were elegantly printed letters, and as he accepted the razor, he read the letters slowly, unbelievingly. On his face, the dismay was so great that she had to cover her mouth to keep from laughing.
What's wrong? She said.
No words were audible. He stared at the box.
Oh, she said innocently, my diaphragm. I had that out the other night. Didn't you notice?
Still, he said nothing.
No, she said. I guess you didn't. I have to use it.
She was curious.
Doesn't Rachel own a diaphragm?
No.
Do you know what a diaphragm is?
His lips moved.
Sure. She can get one now, she said, now that she's married. She ought to have one. Tell her. What do you use instead?
Nothing.
She should use something. A diaphragm is the safest. She can go to a gynecologist and get herself fitted. They'll measure her, and then she can get it in any drugstore. This one belongs to me and Jim. I got it when we were married. By the California joint property laws, half of it is his.
She was enjoying herself, and she pursued him back into the bathroom. His arms and face vanished under the spray of water in the bowl. His back to her, he began industriously to wash and lather himself. While he shaved, stripped down to his pants, she was leaning against the door jamb, her arms folded. The bathroom was steamy and warm, and she thought how much it was like some safe cavern. It was womb-like, isolated from the world. The noise of the water blanked out other sounds. The smell of lather filled her nose, the sweet, wet smell.
"Jim shaves twice a day," she said. "His beard is heavy. It's like steel wires in the morning." "Do many men shave that often? I guess having to shave is really the worst of the two."
"To what?" Washing his face, he began to dry himself. He buried his face in a towel.
"You wouldn't want to know," she said, teasing him, playing with him.
She walked nearer to him, and then all at once her delight vanished. In its place was lust, and she put her arms around his bare waist and clutched him as lightly as she could. She prevented herself from laying hold of him with her real devotion.
"Watch it,"
he said a little apprehensively. And then she thought, with clarity, that her ambition had been opened to him at last. At once she released him. Flustered and embarrassed, she retreated. "My child," she thought. Now he put his shirt back on and began to button it. A sullen boy, she thought, controlling her hunger, permitting the mere dreams, the desires and hallucinations to gallop through her mind. The scenes fled past, and she reviewed them. She identified them as old fantasies that had always been with her, but could never be acted out. She waited and remained placid until they subsided. But they were not gone. They would never be gone.
"Maybe we ought to leave," Art said. She said, "I want you in the most awful kind of way. So maybe we should. Have you ever seen a woman with a new baby?"
"That's not me," he said.
"I won't hurt you," she said. "I just want to be close to you. I'll be careful. But at least let me buy your clothes for you."
She wanted to dress him and comb his hair, but she kept her hands away from him. A great, expanding bloom of love and weakness loosed itself inside her. It detached itself from her and rose up. It hovered within her throat, and then it came forth in a muffled shriek. She walked hurriedly away from him, not wanting him to hear, but he was aware, in some dull fashion, so it made no difference. She could not conceal it from him, and anyhow, she thought, he did not care.
"I don't expect you to give me what I want," she said.
"You want a baby," he said knowingly. "That's what it is."
"Don't hate me," she said, trying not to plead.
But it did not matter what she did, because she was not going to be able to get what she wanted. He did not have it to give her. The suitcases were packed in the trunk compartment and in the back seat of the car. She shut off the gas in the kitchen of the apartment. She made certain that the faucets and lights were off and that the door was locked.
"That does it," she said.
They got into the car and she watched the apartment house disappear behind them. They stopped at the bank and then at a men's clothing store on Market Street. When they left the clothing store, Art drove in the direction of the freeway. He paid no attention to her. He was involved in the driving.
"South?" she asked. "Do you like it better down south?"
Without answering, he made a left turn onto the freeway. Now they were above the houses and the streets of the city. Everything was grimy, she thought, run down and dismal.
"Art," she said, "I want to ask you something. If you weren't married, if you didn't have a wife and you weren't expecting a baby, and say you were a couple of years older and I was, say, 24 instead of 27,
she turned to face him. but when it came down to it, she was unable to say it. What? He said. Struggling, she said,
Would you want to marry me?
Sure, he said. I want to marry you now.
You can't, Art, she said. Don't even think about it.
Why not?
Art, she said, you just make yourself more miserable.
In that instant, she felt like crying. With effort, she said,
You can't leave Rachel. She's a wonderful person. She's a lot finer person than I am. I know that.
No, he said.
It's the truth. If I were anything at all, I wouldn't be here with you. I'd have broken it off after that first night. But I don't have the strength. I'm too weak, Art.
And it was true, she thought. It really was true. She could not deny it.
It's just delaying it. Sooner or later, we have to break it off. I keep telling myself, we had to now, right now. I'm too old and you're too young, but we keep on going along. Someday, we'll have to pay for this.
No, he said. Why do we have to stop?
We'll want to. This isn't healthy or right. There's nothing really good between us.
I don't know, he said. He listened to her. He heard what she was saying, but he did not agree. Now, turning, he saw her lips, dark and full, moving close to his. She was rising toward him. Maybe it was true, he thought. Her lips tingled against his own. With her gloved hand, she touched his face, pressing her fingers to him avidly. Her nostrils flared. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the trembling beneath the layers of powder and lipstick, the quivering of her lips and chin. She smelled like raspberries, a hot, sweet smell, a sticky smell. Her veil was up. She had lifted it aside to kiss him. And the beautiful long legs, he thought. Nothing in this life was permanent. No sensation, not the most vivid nor the most meaningful. Not even this. She was right. The feel of them was gone already, and one day even the sight would be gone. And, he thought, someday, in a few decades, the legs themselves, the superb body, the arms and face and dark hair and waist would perish and vanish and become ashes. And he would not remember them because he would be dead too. All the intricate working parts would stop working. The joints would dissolve and the fluids would dry up. And it would be dust. Dust. He thought, if this could go, then anything could and would go. Nothing could be saved. Nothing survived. Where was all the talk, the music and fun and cars and places? Here went the greatest of the sensibilities. Here went civilization itself in its blue suit and veil and heels and matching person gloves. Thousands of years had gone into the forming of this object. The hell with the buildings and cities and documents and ideas, the armies and ships and societies. They had persons prepared to lament for them. He lamented this. He thought, I was out to get this as soon as I laid eyes on it. And I did get it. And I did have it. And it was every bit as good as I had imagined. In the vicinity of Redwood City, he left the freeway and crossed to El Camino Real. Near Menlo Park, at the side of the highway, was a motel. Why not here, he thought. Starting, Pat raised her head and looked out.
Are you stopping?
This looks like what we want, he said.
A motel, she said, reading the sign. The Four Aces Motel.
It looks clean, he said.
I've never stayed at a motel. We always had the cabin if we wanted to go somewhere. How far is this from San Francisco?
Around 20 miles, Art said. When he had brought the car up onto the gravel shoulder and had parked, she got out and looked back in the direction they had come. To the north was San Francisco, too far now to see, but nonetheless there. She felt its closeness. The line of office buildings, like two-dimensional cardboard cutouts, assembled and pasted up against the late afternoon haze. The air was dry and tasted of cinders. She sniffed. She inhaled the presence of trucks and cars, the skyborne wastes from factories. Into San Francisco went concrete ramps, the freeway system over which they had come. The ramps were high off the ground, elevated, remote. The cars whizzed along, and the lines of traffic divided, passed in various directions, passed under the black directional signs with letters as large as the cars themselves. To her, this sense of the city, this view of it, was disturbing, and at the same time exhilarating. To be here on the edge of the city, to be camped just outside, not in it, but beside it, close enough to enter if she wanted, far enough out so that she was away. She was free, on her own, not bound or contained by it. The trucks rumbled past, the huge diesel trucks. Under her feet, the pavement shook. Ah, she thought, breathing in the air. The freedom, the sense of motion, the trucks, the cars. Everything was on its way somewhere. Transition, she thought. There was nothing stable here, nothing fixed. She could be anything she wanted. This was the edge.